Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I don't want to get the other 250 towns and cities jealous, but I've got it bad for Orwell. The town around the green looks like something right off a model train display, with a bank that just has the word bank painted on the brick wall over the entrance, with the old-time teller cages inside. There's Buxton's General Store, where they make great sandwiches that you can then enjoy in the gazebo out on the town green. Church, school, library all ring the green. It's idyllic. Animal Farm, just outside of town, is run by Diane St. Clair, who creates amazing butter and world-class perfumes. That's right. And over on the lake, there's a state historical site with great walking trails, and that's where we're headed today, to Mount Independence. Joining me now to take us on a journey back in time and up to the present day is Elsa Gilbertson, Regional Historic Site Administrator for the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation. Elsa, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on your airwaves tour to Mount Independence today. It's a beautiful day for a visit.
Oh, excellent. That's a perfect time to come to Mount Independence. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Elsa about Mount Independence, or if you've already visited and you want to share something about it, give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. When was it first built, Elsa?
Yes, well, that's a good question, because we have to say first that the Native Americans were here for thousands of years before anybody of European descent was here. And during the French and Indian War period, when there was the French fort over on the other side of the lake, the soldiers would come over here to cut wood in the winter. And then it really became important during the American Revolution. So we often just think about the revolution happening like in Massachusetts and New York and Virginia, but there was a lot happening here on Lake Champlain. So in the spring of 1776, the Americans were making their way down the lake from Canada. They were had been trying to get that to be part of the United, what would become the United States, but weren't doing so well on that. So they were retreating, and some of the officers stopped at Crown Point, which is further up the lake. And in the meantime, others had been scouting around the lake to see where it would be a good place to make a stand, because this was a good way to defend New England from the British, who were to the north in Canada. And so in early July, the officers decided that they would make a new defense at what would become Mount Independence. And they started work almost right away, so in early July of 1776.
Now, Fort Ticonderoga was right across the lake. So why would you build a fort just, you know, across this little bit of the lake over on Mount Independence?
Yes, it's all to do with strategy and tactics. So during the French and Indian War, the fort that was built over on the other side of the lake was built by the French, and it was facing south, because at that time the French were to the north and their enemy, the English, were to the south. So it was good that the defenses faced south. But then during this part of the American Revolution, the enemy of the Americans was the British, who were to the north. And so this is kind of simplistic, but the old fort was facing the wrong way. So they looked across the lake and saw this amazing peninsula, and it's like almost at the highest point, almost 200 feet above Lake Champlain, and it was pointing north. And there are all kinds of cliffs and And it was a good strategic location. So they decided that it would be better to build, well, they tried to beef up some of the defenses on the Fort Ticonderoga side and then build a whole new defense on what would be the Vermont side.
And weren't the two connected at one time?
Yes. They had a floating bridge for a while between the two points. This is such a strategic spot on the lake. There are a couple of narrows that are strategic between Crown Point and Chimney Point just to the north, and then here between Orwell and Ticonderoga. And so at first, as I say, there was this floating bridge built, and then in March of 1777, Jedithan Baldwin, who was the American engineer, started another bridge, and it was pretty amazing, these huge logs that they got and hauled onto the ice and built these caissons on the ice and filled them with rocks, and then they sunk through the ice. And the interesting thing is that the Americans were just about to finish it by late June, early July of 77, when the British were coming and they had to leave it. So, but when the Germans, who were with the British, came here after the Americans left, they marveled at the bridge. They thought it was one of the great engineering wonders of the world.
Oh, I love it. At their peak, Elsa, how many people were stationed in the two forts, Ticonderoga and Mount Independence?
Yeah, so that would be in the fall of 1776. And I'm sure lots of listeners know that about the Battle of Valcour that was way to the north in the lake in September of 76. And the Americans here knew that the British were coming south on the lake, and so a lot of troops were called in from all over the place, and they were getting ready for the British. And so there were, it's thought, at least about 12,000 people here on both sides of the lake. And so that made it one of the largest population centers in the United States, what would be the United States, after, like, Boston and New York and Philadelphia. So you can imagine 12,000 people even today in Vermont. That's a lot for a town, right?
Oh, my, that is incredible. And when you visit Mount Independence and you think, wow, all this going on what now, you know, it's this beautiful piece of land, and you just can't imagine until you go into the visitor center. We'll talk about that in a little bit. How significant was Mount Independence then?
Yeah, so today it is a National Historic Landmark, and of course it's a Vermont State Historic Site. And some years ago, the National Park Service did a congressional study on sites of the Revolution and the War of 1812, and Mount Independence is one of the top ones in the American Revolution. And there weren't any battles here as such, but it was like the only major defense totally built from scratch by the Americans during the Revolution. And in that October 76 that I was talking about, after the Battle of Valcour, the British were coming down the lake to kind of see how far they could go. Of course, it was getting to be cold and winter, and they didn't have enough supplies, but they saw Mount Independence and Fort Ty bristling with cannon and loads of people. So the British decided that they'd better go back to Canada for the winter. So this delay in the war bought the Americans some time to then get ready for the next year of the battle. And this was considered a defense of New England because Lake Champlain really was the major superhighway of the time, the easiest way to travel around. There was a military road that was built in starting in September of 76, kind of crossing the state, but very rugged. So because this was the super highway, it was the way the most danger might come from the enemy. So it was important as a defense in that way.
How did Mount Independence get its name, and how long was it in service?
Yeah, I love the story of how it got its name. So at first it was called Rattlesnake Hill, because there were Rattlesnake Hills and a couple of other names. And then in July of 76, we know something important happened, right? On July 4th, that the Declaration of Independence was passed. And they sent copies of it to, I think, various outposts around. So it's known by about July 18th that the Declaration of Independence arrived at this area, and then it was read to the assembled troops on the 28th. And after that, even a little bit before, you start seeing maybe that it was, instead of being called Rattlesnake Hill and some of the other names, it was named Mount Independence. So it is indeed named after the Declaration of Independence.
And how long was it in use?
Yeah, so the Americans then started building it in early July of 76. Then they left on the night of July 5th and 6th, 1777. And then the British were here with their German allies from that day up until November 8th, when they had gotten word that British General John Burgoyne had surrendered after the battles of Saratoga, and they decided, well, maybe they would go back to Canada. So the last major occupation ended on November 8th, but there still was some other activity here. And like a few years later, when the British left, they tried to burn and destroy everything so it couldn't be used again. But then they came again in 1780 and burned it again. So there's a little bit of activity after November of 77.
All right.
But that was the main part.
Elsa, when someone visits now, describe the visitor center and its significance.
Yeah, great. Well, it's interesting how you drive in on the Mount Independence Road, and that was part of the original road to get here during the Revolution. And you come around the corner, and there's this really interesting building that was built in 1996, and it's in the shape of a bateau, so one of the boats that would have been on the lake during the Revolution. And you come in, and it's all a little on the dark side in here because we want to immerse you into the history of Mount Independence. And in here, then, you learn about the history through the artifacts that have been found during archaeological investigation. So anything from bits of china that they would have used, you know, for dishes for their meals, to a cannon that was found in the waters just north of the point here, to logs and a powder horn, and there's a short orientation film too. So then when we send you out on the trails, you kind of know what to expect. And so you go out onto the grounds after that and start going up the hill, and the visitor center disappears. And so then you're back in time.
Yeah, what will people be able to explore there on the grounds of Mount Independence?
Yeah, so we have over 6 miles of trails, and the one closest to the building actually meets outdoor standards for handicapped accessibility. So if you have an outdoor wheelchair, then that's a great way you can go around the southern half of the mount. So that main trail is called the Baldwin Trail, named after the engineer here. And it's got a number of great interpretive signs, so you can learn about what happened at each of those particular points where the signs are. And there are archaeological evidence there, you know, foundations and things like that. And it's on the subtle side because, you know, they built a lot with wood. And so it having been burned twice, you know, the wood didn't survive so much. So there are rocks and things that you can see. And then the other trails, the blue and the orange trail, we have a trail map. And it's got various points on it, and the trail map shows what you can see. And some of the most fun things are the General Hospital site. I feel like we need a soap opera here, based after that name. So 250 feet long. I mean, that's amazing.
Wow, that is.
And then there are a number of gun batteries that have stone along the edges and look out strategically. So there, and then if you don't care about history anyway, you should just come because it's just beautiful here. Mm-hmm. And there are lovely views of the lake, and you can look over to Fort Ticonderoga. You can have a picnic here. There's lots of interesting birds, and sometimes you see other animals, deer, and there was a bobcat here last year.
Wow.
So it's something for everybody.
Are the trails open year-round?
Yes, they are. It's just that in the winter it's a little hard to get in here because of the snow, you mm-hmm. know, and not being able to park. But, yes, you're welcome anytime. And then the site opens officially for the season on May 29th, and it'll be open 6 days a week, Tuesdays through Sundays, 10 to 5.
Oh, excellent.
Until October 10th.
All right. And are there, I think you do reenactments, don't you, on the grounds at times?
Yes. So every year we have a Living History Weekend. Well, last year it was a day because of the situation. This year we're at least having a day on the Labor Day weekend, and our reenactor friends come. So those who portray the Americans who are here and the British. And we have one of the fun things about that event is we have what's called a Baldwin Trail walkabout. So there are stations along this walkabout, usually six maybe, with various knowledgeable volunteers and reenactors. And they tell you something specific maybe that happened in that area, or they demonstrate specific skills. And it's really fun because the people, the living experts, are kind of pulling the knowledge out of the ground where they're standing, and then the public gets to interact with them. And it's, you know, we walk in the footsteps of history. You can kind of feel it coming through the soles of your feet.
Yeah. Now, Elsa, you're also the site administrator for Hubbardton Battlefield and Chimney Point, and we only have a few more minutes, but I'd love for you to give some love to each of them. Hubbardton Battlefield, the only place where a Revolutionary War was fought on Vermont soil, right?
Yes, and so when the Americans left here in that night of July 5th and 6th, they were heading, a lot of them were heading that way, and there was a rear guard that engaged with the pursuing British on the early morning of July 7th. And that's another site that's so beautiful with mountain views, and you can't believe how peaceful it is now. But there was a bloody battle there, and the Americans were able to stop the British. The British technically won because they kept the field, but the Americans stopped them from pursuing. So that's how we are there, and we're open in early July there this year. And then at Chimney Point, which is further up the lake across from Crown Point at the foot of the Lake Champlain Bridge, we look at the history of the three earliest cultures there, the Native American, the French colonial, and the early American history. And there was a French fort there built in 1731, and the building that's there now is a tavern that was built about 85, and that's another gorgeous spot. Vermont is really lucky, and with a lot of hard work from many people, though, to be so beautiful. And so there's whatever you're interested in, there's plenty to see and do.
And also, why do you think it's important to learn about the role of each of these that they played in the formation of our country?
Well, at some of these places, there were so many people who had to work together to make something happen. And it has an effect on us today because this is, this is where our country came out of. And it's kind of nice to be reminded that what we do today might have an effect, 50 or 100 years from now. And the thing is about history is that it makes you feel at home, whether you've lived here forever or you're new. It just kind of embraces you and makes you feel like you're part of something.
We only have about 30 seconds, but if there's one spot between those three sites that you would say, just for this site alone, this spot alone, you should come visit and see this.
Great. Well, thank you. So there's everything. Mount Independence, you'd only have a little bit of time. Just a little bit away from the visitor center is our Southern Battery, and you can really see the three levels of defenses and look out onto the lake and be marveled at what these people built in such a hurry, that there was nothing here and they had to bring in all their equipment, and it's just a gorgeous location.
Elsa Gilbertson is a regional historic site administrator for the Vermont Division of Historic Preservation, and you can find more about Mount Independence at historicsites.vermont.gov. Elsa, thank you so much for teaching us about these wonderful places.
Oh, thank you for your visit today.
That was great.
Sure,
perfect day. I will.
Visit. Yes.
Excellent. All right, let's take a break. We're going to go to CBS News Update. When we return, we're going to learn about the True North Wilderness Program. And a reminder that coming up at 11 this morning, we'll bring you the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Sometimes we could all use a little help. Teenagers happen to be living through what many of us recall as the more challenging years, navigating school, friendships, family obligations, and the vast and unknowable future and what it will hold. In some situations, young adults and adolescents need more help than their family or school can provide. Put together the need for a little help and the beauty of Vermont, and you have True North, a licensed residential treatment and wilderness therapy program. Here to tell us about True North is Maudery Barefoot, a founder and owner of True North. Maud, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. And Allison McHugh is here as well. She's the program's research and alumni coordinator. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's really nice to be on the show.
Great. Now, listeners, if you've got a question for our guests, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Allison, how do you describe True North when you talk to someone about it and they're not familiar with it?
So True North is a wilderness therapy program, like you said. A lot of residential treatment centers are using buildings, and we tend to use the outdoors. So our students are living 24/7 in the wilderness, in the national forest, state forest, and on our winter campus in Vermont. So they're not sleeping indoors; they're sleeping outdoors, and they're learning skills like making fires, striking a bearing and hiking through the woods. They're learning all the skills to sort of keep their group safe, warm, well-fed, et cetera. And they're also diving into what we call more of the softer skills or the emotional work that they need to do to move their families forward. So it's a very unique kind of treatment. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of an honor and a privilege to work with these families. And being from Vermont myself, I know how powerful the outdoors can be. It's an amazing environment to do all the kinds of work that our students and families come to us for.
Maud, this is a unique approach. Can you share the story of how this all began?
Sure. My husband Ty, our other co-founder and executive director, and I met at a similar wilderness therapy program in 1999 in Idaho and began working as field guides, which are direct care staff that are responsible for supervising and guiding young people in wilderness therapy settings. And working in the deserts of Idaho was a profoundly inspiring experience. And as we progressed through graduate school in later years and worked in other clinical settings, we came back again and again to how powerful and enriching that outdoor recreational and experiential setting really can be for all of us. I mean, I think most of us who live in Vermont know how much we can gain from spending time outside, especially extended time outside with other people on our own. There's so much value to that experience. And when you add in some sophisticated clinical modalities and a really supportive group system, and a structured curriculum, it's just a really effective way to reach kids who are struggling in some way in their lives. Once we had a taste of that experience, we knew as therapists that that was really going to be the modality we wanted to continue to work in. I'm originally from Vermont. I grew up in Warren. My family is still here. And after about a decade of living in the Mountain West, which I loved, it's incredible, beautiful place, I wanted to come home. We are still the first and only program of our kind in the state of Vermont, and we took our experience from more established programs out west, and we had to build our own in order to continue to do the kind of work that has been so meaningful and valuable.
Maud, your first student arrived in a snowstorm just before Christmas. So how did it happen that your first session was in winter under those circumstances?
Our intention had been to take that winter of 2005 and early 2006 to continue to build out our program and start to reach out to referral sources. But both Ty and myself had established reputations as wilderness therapists in the field. And a referral source called and said, I just simply can't wait. You have to take the student now. It helped that it was a student and a family I had some previous experience with from another program. And I really, really had connected with this child. She was turning 18. And when she met with her clinical, she said, well, what kind of support do you need to help you feel strong about moving into adulthood? She said, I need Maud. How can I turn that down? I was not going to be able to turn that down. I felt like I needed to be there for this student and her family. And it was really a joy to work with her. Because she had experience already in wilderness settings, she really helped us with some of the early decisions around how we structured food or gear or all kinds of other elements. So we had plenty of experience to draw on, Rick, and we jumped in with both feet.
Wow. Allison, who are the students that come to you? What age groups and what are their needs?
We are serving adolescents who are age 14 to 17 and also young adults who are age 18 to 25. And our students are students who would really benefit from a small group where they get lots of individual attention, both from their individual therapists as well as the guides who are with them 24/7. They're looking to have, you know, therapy several times a week and group therapy every day. And these are also students whose parents are also looking for a comprehensive parent program. So we have dedicated parent therapists as well who work with sponsors, and they typically hold a parent workshop that's an incredible opportunity for the family to come together partway through the stay. But back to you, what you were saying about, you know, who are our students? These are kids who are struggling with anxiety, avoidance, depression. Those are some of the top presenting concerns that we see. And interestingly, the last several years, we've seen numbers really on the rise with students struggling with excessive use of electronics. As you can imagine, technology has sort of overcome a lot of family situations. So that's another area where students might be struggling when they come to us.
And Allison, what kind of background experiences do they have to have in the outdoors and wilderness to really fit into to this program?
Actually, they don't have to have any at all. I would say the majority of our students have not spent a great deal of time outside. Once in a while, we get an experienced Boy Scout or someone who's maybe done a Outward Bound or Knowles type experience. Mm-hmm. But typically, we're getting kids who are maybe feeling really stuck in life and that maybe, you know, just stuck at home, especially in the pandemic. We're seeing lots of kids increase in those experiences of anxiety and depression based on being stuck inside and not having the socialization that they're used to.
Maude, let's talk about the logistics. How do you feed the students? How are their possessions moved around as they hike and camp?
It's a great question, Rick. Our students become adept at a wide variety of outdoor living skills, including managing their clothing, their gear in their own backpacks. So they really have most of their life on their back. They're camping, as Allison said, every day through the spring, summer, and fall. We do have a winter campus for them in the winter where they're able to sleep inside, you know, wall tents and cabins and yurts, but they still are packing up camp and continuing to have that active flow of moving from site to site. We outfit them with really high quality gear, everything that I or you or anybody might want to have themselves when they're heading out on a backcountry trip. And part of their experience is to learn how each item that we provide them with is going to help to keep them comfortable and safe. And it's everything from rainwear to sleeping bags and you know, the mug for their morning hot chocolate, whatever it might be. We have an incredible operations team, and they have a complex and challenging job that they're really good at. That we literally have a large warehouse space in Whitfield that is dedicated to organizing and housing all of our students' clothing, gear. It's where their food is packed and prepped and stored. And our team delivers food to each group individually several times a week so that they're really only carrying a few days worth of food. Also allows us to provide a lot of fresh ingredients. Our entire diet was created for us by a fantastic whole health nutritional team in Burlington. And the students get to choose items each week from one of our menus, and they can decide what they want to have as a group for dinner. Let's have fajitas. Let's have pasta night. They choose from a variety of fruits and vegetables, different kinds of grains and seasonings and flavorings. Let's have more of an Asian flavor. We'll choose teriyaki sauce, that sort of thing. Mm. Our students also have a lot of opportunity to choose their own personal snacks and food that are just the things they'll munch on throughout the day. What do they want to have for breakfast? The whole curriculum and program model, Rick, is really driven by the idea of wellness and increased independent living and maturity skills. So we're providing a lot of opportunities for our students to really think about and reflect on how these kinds of choices impact the way they feel in their body, in their relationships. So as Allison was saying earlier, most of our students have no experience in the wilderness. But
right.
It's actually the process of learning how to be in the wilderness that can be so valuable. And for those clients who do have experience, they're taking it to the next level and learning how to really integrate it into their life. So it's a big job to clothe and feed these students. And I think we, you know, have a great team who makes sure that our students have really everything that they need.
Allison, how long does it take a student to kind of, you know, acclimate to this new lifestyle?
Sure. It's different for every student, and that's part of the way True North is designed. We sort of allow that process to unfold as it needs to for each of those students. Our Our kids are typically in the program for an average length of stay of 10 to 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And there are four phases of the program. And they have sort of a strengths-based progression through those phases. So the first phase is called Trailhead, and it's all about safety. So it's the student acclimating and learning how to take care of themselves, as Maud was saying, keep track of all of their gear, learn how to build their own shelter, et cetera. And they have two guides in each group with up to seven students, and those guides are there to support the student in learning the skills required to kind of make it through that Trailhead phase. So that could be anywhere from 4 days to a month, you know, to really get settled in and decide what they're going to work on for the rest of their stay.
Maud, what licensure is needed to operate a program like True North in the state of Vermont?
So really, you need to have a residential treatment licensure, which is how we are licensed through the Department of Children and Family. And that is because our students are staying with us, living with us for the entire time that they're here. When we first opened True North, as I mentioned earlier, we were the first and we are still the only wilderness therapy program. And we are really grateful for the team in the state of Vermont. They worked closely with us to develop some standards and regulations for wilderness therapy programs so that we can have that additional level of accreditation, if you will. And then we are also a recognized independent school by the Department of Education.
Gotcha. Allison, how are students assessed, both as far as acceptance into the program and treatment and outcome goals?
Sure. We have a dedicated admissions team that works with families who are interested in the program. And there's quite an extensive process of learning about the family and figuring out if True North is a good fit for that family. We also work with a variety of different referral sources, therapeutic and educational consultants, as well as mental health professionals all over the world, really, who know about what we do, and they call us typically knowing somewhat that a family might be a good fit. So we do lots of phone calls, listen really carefully to families as they tell their story to learn if True North is going to be the best fit for their student as well as their whole family, because we treat the whole family. And you asked about outcomes, et cetera. So True North is a research-designated program. We're a member of NATSAP, which is the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. So we are very dedicated to research and participating both internally as well as in a broader national study on the efficacy of wilderness therapy. So we do optional surveys for that research. We invite our families to participate when they arrive, and again when they graduate. We also reach out 6 months and 12 months down the road, which helps us to kind of keep in touch with our alumni as well as invite them to continue their participation in that research. And those outcomes are all available to look at on our website, truenorthwilderness.com. You can see the numbers that prove that what we do really helps families. And again, you know, families are optionally participating, but in general, most families do. They understand that, building more and more data sets that show the stories we're telling about their experience in the woods actually translates to scientific proof that the feelings of anxiety and depression are reducing, that students are increasing their self-confidence. All the goals that they have, we're helping them to be on their way toward accomplishing them.
Maud, we only have a couple minutes left, but I would like to talk about family. You've both mentioned this several times, treating the whole family, involving the whole family. How is that done?
We really invite every member of a family to participate, Rick, especially parents. You know, oftentimes treatment modalities will sideline family members who aren't directly participating. And our feeling is that our goal is whole family health. And if everyone in the family system has a voice and is asked to participate directly, provided their parents have their own curriculum at True North, they have a dedicated therapist, weekly therapy sessions with all therapies and our therapists, and we ask them to collaborate together. There are a lot of nexus points for families and students in the True North program where they're exchanging structured letters with each other based on therapeutic assignments that are designed to open up channels of communication, provide opportunities to reconnect, to kind of clear the air with some past hurts and conflicts, and really create a pretty clear path towards a closer, healthier family relationship. Siblings can participate. Sometimes we have grandparents participate. The goal here is not just that a student is successful in the 2 or 3 months that they're here in Vermont with us, but that we're really creating a foundation for them to be successful in their family system and outside of their family system for the rest of their life. And so to do that, we feel strongly that the whole family needs to participate. This is, you know, something that I think is attractive to a lot of families who choose to work with True North, that they really get to engage with their child on this really special journey and not feel like they're watching from the outside in.
And Maude, are you able to, and we only have about a minute, but are you able to individualize programs for a student?
Absolutely. It's really our hallmark. It's really what we're known for as a program is our small group size. Our therapist caseloads max out at 7, which is an incredibly high student-to-staff ratio. They also have full treatment teams of guides and other personnel who are there to sort of hold them and support them. So within our broader curriculum, we individualize very specifically personal goals and paths that students are working toward based on who they are as an individual and the hopes and expectations of their particular family and life situation. So that is our goal always.
Maude Barefoot is founder and co-owner of True North. Allison McHugh is the program's research and alumni coordinator. Hey, thank you both for being on. This was very interesting.
Thanks so much, Rick. It was fun.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. We're going to break now for CBS News, and then we'll be back to talk with national correspondent Bob Ney. And Sox fans, tune in this evening beginning at 6:05 for pregame coverage. First pitch, 7:05. The Red Sox open their weekend series in Baltimore against the O's. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and it is time to turn to national correspondent Bob Ney to get caught up on what's happening in the world. Bob, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Rick.
All right, Bob, let's start off with the numbers for COVID.
Yes, for the total recoveries worldwide is 91 million, some recoveries. Total death worldwide is 3,247,000. And in our own country, the total deaths are 580,000. And it's obvious as we head towards July, the target date of 70% some that hopefully will be vaccinated. But it is obvious that the rates are having, you know, an impact and they're declining in the death rate. Although we obviously do have deaths, it is declining. Now the rest of the world, frankly, is becoming potential problem because it could make the variants much more stronger that would come back to haunt us. And I mentioned that because we're going to reach probably the 70%, as I just said, by July 4th. Mm-hmm. But about, as of today, Rick, only 8% of all people in the world, the rest of the world, have received one dose.
Wow.
8%. That's nothing, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, we run through these numbers every week, and, you know, we're starting to get a little bit, I don't know, maybe anesthetized, a little immune to it. But, you know, think about this. In a year and a half ago, we didn't know anything about COVID-19, and we have lost over 3 million people worldwide to this.
Yes, and here in the United States, 580,000 people.
Yeah.
Nobody ever thought it would get that high.
And I want to talk about India. I know this is a very special place for you. And yesterday 440,000 new cases.
Yes, India is in a real major problem. And I did want to mention, it doesn't get as much attention, but Africa also has, you know, a major problem because they're not getting vaccinations. Barely anybody has been vaccinated. But India continues to have a major problem, increasing cases, lack of oxygen, lack of hospital facilities. So in India's case, it's, you know, when you look at the infrastructure of India, if the United States were in the same boat as India with our infrastructure, instead of you and I talking about 580,000 today, we would have probably been talking about over a million some people. India is running out of oxygen. A lot of areas have very little health care. The area I go into in northern India has three hospitals that are small that I know of. So the infrastructure is just not there to handle something like this. And the fact that very few people for 1.2 billion population have been vaccinated obviously doesn't help.
No, not at all. Now, there was President Joe Biden had a plan about the vaccine patents. What was that all about, and how's that been received?
Well, you know, this is really interesting, Rick, because the Biden administration really shocked the world. They came out in favor of waiving patents for coronavirus vaccines, which I think is good. I think anybody that looks at this would say, fine, you waive the patents, so it's more free to get the vaccine out there. But the opinion in Europe is divided. The European Commission President Leyen said Brussels would be willing to discuss this. French President Emmanuel Macron said he backed the United States, backed President Biden, but the German government spokesperson said this is going to cause severe complications, and it's boiling down to money, because if the patents are suspended, then the theory is some of the drug companies will not, you know, continue with this because they won't have the patent on it for the monetary purposes. So, I mean, I think that the president did what he needed to do on this in a very special circumstance, but obviously Big Pharma is not going to be quite happy about it.
No, no, they're not.
Not at all.
Yeah. All right, another kind of COVID-related item is from the courts, and an eviction, that eviction moratorium that's been in place overturned.
Yes. This story I watched with a lot of intensity because it's, you know, it went from federal government funded programs, like, for example, if you were in housing funded by the federal government, you would have a moratorium. Then it went to basically the general population of the United States to have a eviction moratorium. I actually know a couple personally who the landlord did try to evict them anyway, and they tried it by sidestepping the Center for Disease Control's order, and they tried to get them on other violations, you know, saying that they weren't taking care of the property or whatever. But it was actually boiling down to their lack of being able to pay the rent. So some of the people have done that. Now, I think generally there's some sympathy that, you know, landlords have to, you know, have to keep going too. That may be why the federal judge has said, okay, we're going to lift the moratorium. Now, the government's going to have to appeal that. So right now, technically, this moratorium will come to an end unless the government is successful in, you know, doing something about that through the appeal process. It would be through June 30th, and it would end.
All right. And talking about schools, it looks like a big push to hopefully have students back in school, in-person schooling, by the fall.
Well, I think this one's going to be hailed, Rick, as a win, although it's going to have controversy. People are going to ask about the safety factor for students and, you know, children, mm-hmm. and that's understandable. But President Biden's Education Secretary, Miguel Cardona, told NBC News yesterday that he expects, quote, all schools to be open full-time in person for all students by September. So you can see where the White House is making a push to get kids back in. All of the studies, all of the surveys, and I know we have to look at, you know, safety of children, obviously, but all of the studies and surveys are pointing towards a very bad situation in many ways, mental health, education issues, depression rates up, et cetera. because of the students not being back in school. So I think that's one of the things that the Biden administration has taken into account with this announcement.
Now, the Biden administration is thinking about unfreezing some Iranian assets. So why are they thinking of doing that? What effect would it have?
Well, now this one, and I followed the Iran issue forever. As you know, I lived in Iran in 1978 during the beginning of the revolution of the Shah. And in Congress, I worked with issues, in fact, with then-Senator Biden's office with Iranian issues through two presidents. And then, you know, there, of course, was President Obama and Vice President Biden. They did the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump did away with it his second year in office. And the rest is history. We've come to a stalemate, although we're talking sort of, not directly, but talking in Vienna. So this is twofold. One, the $1 billion would be sort of a good faith show to Iran that we're willing to do something because there's additional sanctions that were imposed. And the other part to this is, and this is where I think the administration was very, very smart. They're not handing $1 billion in cash to the Iranians. They are going through a Swiss channel known as the Swiss Humanitarian Trade Agreement to give Iran supplies, medical supplies. Iran has been extremely hard hit, and usually we really don't hurt countries, no matter how much we're at odds with them, by hurting them humanitarianly. So in this case, they are going to convert this through the Swiss for Iran to use it for humanitarian purposes internally in their country.
All right. And there was that investigation into Donald Trump, the hush money from the election. What was that about, and where has that gone?
Well, Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer, can't be happy because obviously they went after him for the hush money, but it still had a pending investigation for the Federal Election Commission, which is now split three Republicans to three Democrats. And they had a closed-door meeting in February, which I find very interesting that it was closed-door. I would assume they would have wanted to have a little bit more light on this, but they didn't. But they had closed-door, and basically the bottom line is I think it's dead-tied, and they've just dropped it as far as any responsibility by former President Trump. So the responsibility of this money and the use of campaign funds, because that's what the FEC does, right. Federal Elections Commission, is all laying upon Cohen, not the former president.
Gotcha. National correspondent Bob Ney, as always, I want to thank you for sharing your insight into what's happening around the country and the world. Always great having you.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. Okay, so your city or town wants to make a change to its charter. The residents vote on it, pass it, voila, make the change. Yeah, not so fast. The legislature has a thing or two they want to say about your little charter change there. And this has municipalities around the state a little cheesed. 7 Days political reporter Colin Flanders looked into this, and he's here to tell us what he's learned. Colin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what exactly is a municipal charter?
So a municipal charter is essentially a document that gives Vermont municipalities the authority to go above and beyond what state law allows them to. So the majority of Vermont cities and towns simply follow state law in their local governance, but about 85 municipalities have adopted these charters. Usually they are larger communities, larger governments, that offer a wide range of services, and they give the community an opportunity to do things that state law hasn't contemplated.
Give an example of something like that.
Sure, sure. So, for example, one in the town of Burlington, or in the city of Burlington, recently they passed a number of charter changes that they're hoping to put into their charter, one being a ban on no-cause evictions. Another one is a move to ranked choice voting. These are things that state law does not allow them to do, and so they need to ask express permission to enact these changes.
And if they were a city or a town without a charter, they would not be able to do that?
They would not be able to do that. The only remedy at that point is to either create a charter or to lobby state lawmakers to change state law in favor of whatever you want to do.
Or break away and become your own state. Okay, so what's the difference between like a town ordinance and something that is actual that requires a charter change?
Yeah, so often ordinances are things that are created with permission from your charter. So a lot of times if a municipality wants to enact a new ordinance, they have to also go through the process of changing their charter to make reference to that ordinance. Sometimes these changes can be made already with existing language in the charter, but sometimes, for example, Burlington a handful of years ago wanted to enact some changes to gun ordinances. They had to change their charter and ran into some problems in the legislature. Mm.
All right, so let's talk about the logistics for a city or town to make a charter change. First, locally, what do they have to do?
So the first thing they have to do is hold a pair of public hearings. And before I was at 7 Days, I used to work at a few community newspapers, and I covered the town of Essex pretty extensively. And I can tell you that these are not things that are taken lightly. When the word charter change starts getting thrown around, I think most elected officials recognize that it's going to be a pretty long haul. Mm-hmm. So you have the two public hearings during which people can give feedback on how they think the charter change should be worded. Maybe they don't like it at all. Often municipalities will tweak the language or change it based on the feedback they get. Then they have to put this out to a townwide vote, and the residents in the community have to approve it. From there, it gets sent to the legislature in the form of a bill and goes through the process any other bill goes through. It has to pass both chambers and then has to get the governor's approval, or he can let it go into law without a signature.
So you said it can be a long process. How long does this normally take?
Yeah, so it can definitely vary, but there are communities who have been going through charter changes for multiple years. I mean, if you just think about it logistically, often communities will try to hold their townwide vote when an existing vote is already in place, so they don't have to pay the money to hold a special election. Mm-hmm. So say you're working on this over the summer. You think, well, we have a November vote coming up. Let's wait until then. They vote on it in November. And then say the legislature gets busy or they don't get to it in time. They're only in session usually for 5 months. If your charter change doesn't move during that time, you have to wait a whole nother year for the legislature to come back around and vote on it or even take it up. So there are ones that are pending that have been in the process for multiple years. And if the biennium changes, then it has to be reintroduced as a bill and the whole process starts again.
Yikes. How often do charter changes get approved and rejected by the legislature?
Yeah, and so this varies year to year. I think on average, over the last 5 or 6 years, it's probably been 3 or 4 that don't go anywhere. I think maybe a 10 or a dozen get introduced each year. But it really varies. And one thing that I heard from supporters of changes to the system is that a lot of this has to do with the legislature that's in place. So some past years, the makeup of the lawmakers in the legislature, they have been people who have been a lot more hesitant to start meddling with individual changes. They like to a little more laissez-faire approach. And then other legislatures, specifically this one right now, likes to really dive into all the details, and that can often drag out the process and get things pushed off.
How minor can a charter change be? I'm thinking of something you wrote about for Winooski, for example.
Yeah, they can be very minor, shockingly minor. I think the Winooski example that I use is that a couple of years ago, the city manager wanted to give the title of human resources director to a staffer who was performing those duties. But the manager found out that because that was not in the city charter and state law did not contemplate this, that she would actually need to go through the process of updating the charter just to make that change. They started those discussions in 2018. A handful of other charter changes got thrown in. By the time that voters had a chance to vote on it last November, the city staffer had already left for another job because she wanted access to the title of the work that she was doing. I mean, there are numerous examples of this, of changes that would seem on its face like something a town should probably be able to do on its own without having to ask the legislature. Yeah, pretty minor.
All right. Now, I'm going to ask you to take both sides, but one side at a time. So, Colin, first of all, make the case for why the legislature should maintain this power over charter changes.
Of course, yeah. Well, I will. The people that I spoke to who are in support of this current system say that it really ensures that the state can foster uniformity, and we don't end up having just this patchwork of very conflicting policies or things like that. I mean, in Vermont, that would probably happen to a lesser degree because of the systems that we have in place in state law. For example, like other states, certain counties or municipalities can set different tax rates or different or vastly different ordinances. That probably wouldn't happen here, but still, supporters of this system say that it helps ensure that we just don't have a bunch of crazy rules when you cross town lines. The other thing is that it can prevent the locals from, essentially, where I put it, from going rogue. One of the examples that I was given is, like, you don't want a municipality to decide that, hey, we're going to balance our town highway budget on traffic fines, and then we're going to lower all of our speed limits to 15 miles an hour and then just set up a police officer at the border and start tagging people as they go through. I mean, that's a pretty dramatic example, and I think it would be hard to imagine that that actually happening. But that's the thought process for a lot of the lawmakers who view themselves as a bit of a gatekeeper or a backstop here to make sure that municipalities aren't doing something that's going to have either unintended consequences or be in violation of state law or just be on its face a little farcical.
All right. And now let's go to the municipality side. Why should this be loosened?
Yeah. So critics say that it gives the state legislature way too much power to meddle in local issues and makes it harder for them to come up with sort of creative solutions to the problems they face. And I think a lot of local officials would agree that more and more they're being expected to, on the local level, to respond to a wide range of very complex problems, problems that might have been viewed as more global or national problems are now becoming local problems. We think of climate change, environmental issues. Over this past year, we've seen all the push for police reforms and this conversation we're having around equity. Local leaders say that they need to be able to have the flexibility to respond in the way that they see fit. And when they need to, for example, take multiple years and go to the legislature to ask just to name a human resources director, they say that stifles their creativity and makes it a lot harder for them to respond to these problems.
What criteria does the legislature use in ruling on a charter change?
Yeah, so I talked to the House Government Operations Chair, and House Government Operations often sees all of these bills, these charter bills come through. And what she told me is that really they look for three things. They look to ensure that local governing boards adequately warned and explained the proposals. That's essentially meaning, like, when it was on the ballot, it was worded right, voters had enough information to understand what they were being asked to do. Then if that bar is cleared, the committee looks to see if the changes conflict with any state law or would result in any unintended consequences. And if all of those bars are met, then the proposal typically moves forward. But I think what some local officials argue is that they think that there's a lot more subjectivity that comes into play, especially when you're dealing with a group of lawmakers who all have may have different political views or might have different opinions about what should be going on in town. They say it's not so clear cut in their mind.
Now, there was a pilot program, a municipal self-governance pilot program. What happened with that idea?
Yeah, so that idea, a spoiler alert, that idea has gone nowhere. But what it would have done is allowed up to 10 towns to send charter change requests to this new commission, which would have vetted the proposals and then made recommendations to the legislature. It really wouldn't have sped up the process that much, but what supporters of the idea said is it would remove a bit of it would have made the process a little less political, and they thought that the legislature, the full legislature, would often just accept the recommendations of the commission. They hoped that one day the commission might even have the final say and remove the entire process from the legislature. It was based on this program in West Virginia where it was eventually expanded statewide after lawmakers there determined that it was helping save money and time. But while the Senate passed it, it was never taken up in the House, and it hasn't been reintroduced.
And we're almost out of time, but despite having to go through the legislature for charter changes, these 85 municipalities, don't they still have, you know, control over most of the things they need to in their town or city?
Sure, yeah, and I think if you ask them, they would definitely say that it's not like there's lawmakers coming into town every day to tell them what to do, but I think broadly it's this concept of having to ask for permission to make changes to things that you see. It's definitely a difficult balance to strike, and I think the conversation is definitely going to be continuing more and more as more of these problems arise, and it'll be interesting to see how it, if any changes are made in the future.
Gotcha. Colin Flanders is a political reporter for 7 Days. You can read his story in this week's issue or at 7daysvt.com. As always, thanks, Colin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Always clarifies some tricky issues. We're going to break for CBS News, then return to talk about the president's environmental pledge. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. A couple of weeks ago, President Joe Biden used the occasion of Earth Day to outline his environmental initiatives for the country, and they're pretty aggressive in his quest to fight climate change. I'm joined by Jennifer Rushlow, the director of the Environmental Law Center at Vermont Law School. And Jennifer, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Professor Rushlow a question or share a comment about the president's environmental pledge, we're at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jennifer, what specifically is President Biden pledging when it comes to the environment?
President Biden committed to reducing greenhouse gas emission pollution in the United States by 50 to 52% below 2005 levels by 2030. So that's a sweeping economy-wide reduction in greenhouse gas emissions aimed at mitigating the effects of global warming.
Now, how does this compare to the initiatives of President Trump and before him, President Obama?
This is a greater reduction in greenhouse gas emissions than what Obama did. And, I mean, President Trump pulled us out of the climate commitments that had been made under President Obama and previous administrations. So it's really restoring and going above what President Obama did and kind of making up for lost time during the Trump administration.
So would you say that the Biden's initiative is significant? And second of all, is it reachable?
It's incredibly significant and such welcome news for anybody concerned about climate change. It's ambitious, but I do think it's reachable. The devil is going to be in the details. You know, we're going to need to see really effective legislation and executive orders that take this broad mandate and turn it into bite-sized pieces of law. Because, you know, just saying we're going to reduce our emissions by X amount by a certain date, that's not enough to make it happen. It really has to be broken down into, okay, for this particular set of sources in this sector, how much are we going to require them to reduce their emissions, and how are we going to require them to do it? So it really requires that it's, you know, scientific analysis that's specific to different kinds of greenhouse gas emission sources.
Yeah, I'm glad you used the term bite size, because I'm wondering if this has any kind of teeth to get to these goals. So what legislation will be needed to reach these goals? What kind of legislation?
Well, I'm sure President Biden is hoping that he can do a good amount of it through executive orders, right, so that he doesn't have to face some of the same political challenges. And there is a lot that he can do through rulemaking, through the Environmental Protection Agency and other administrative actions like that, which really just require him to go to his cabinet and say, you know, this is what we want to do. We want to have, we want to make sure our regulations for emissions from coal plants change in this particular way that reduces emissions. And of course, the rulemaking process requires public input. And so there's certainly a public process around that, but it doesn't necessarily require the same kind of bipartisanship agreement that legislation does. And we're going to either need to see a series of very powerful bills focused on different sectors for greenhouse gas emissions, or we're going to need to see some kind of sweeping climate legislation, which is difficult in a Congress that is pretty divided right now.
Yeah. Has Joe Biden always been a proponent of this level on environmental initiatives?
I think it's safe to say this is going even beyond what some might have expected from him. I don't think he's ever been bad on the environment, but this is a really important step. And I think, for even some of the progressives that may have felt like Biden was too centrist for them at election time, I think some of them are probably feeling pretty good about the fact that Biden really is taking a stand on this. But that being said, I don't know how much of a choice we have here. Biden did pledge to rejoin the Paris Agreement, and that requires us to make certain decisions as a country to reduce our emissions substantially. There are things that Biden has a history of caring about, like the middle class, working class, jobs for Americans. And all of those things are going to be impacted very negatively by climate change and could be impacted positively by the creation of clean energy jobs. And so from that perspective, this is very consistent with some of the priorities that we've seen before from President Biden.
Have we made strides in this country to move towards the goals that were set by the Obama administration?
We certainly have. At the federal level, it's been really up and down, and that is the nature of having a pretty divided country where, the swing from President Obama to President Trump was really significant and kind of undid a lot we had done. But because of the way the federal government has been over the 4 years under President Trump, the states were able to take significant action. And so, states like Massachusetts and Vermont and California, New York, many others have state global warming solutions acts, as they're often called, or other kinds of climate legislation that take major steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions economy-wide. And so while we've been kind of wringing our hands at the federal level, at the state level, we've made a lot of great progress. And that's just from a public policy standpoint. We've also seen a lot of movement from the private sector, because even though President Trump was not one to pursue public policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the private sector sees the writing on the wall that we're only moving in one direction in terms of needing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and address climate change. And so you can see that, for instance, the car manufacturers have made big strides toward producing electric vehicles and marketing those vehicles, even in the last 4 years when that wasn't being promoted federally. So we are making good progress. We need to do a lot more, though.
Now, Jennifer, 2020, an odd year, but how did 2020 affect our reaching these goals? We were driving less, telecommuting, things like that. So what effect did that have?
Certainly, it was temporarily a helpful thing from a climate change standpoint. Obviously a terrible year for so many people in so many ways. But from, purely from an environmental standpoint and a climate change standpoint, it was a bit of a reprieve. People were driving less. We were producing less in terms of manufacturing. Pollution levels were just down. But just as we're seeing the economy bounce back, and, I've heard people refer to what we're going through now as sort of the roaring 20s, where after you know, these difficult times, people are excited to spend their money again. And, you know, there's waits to purchase items while manufacturers catch up with demand. I expect that we'll probably see an offset of those pollution reductions with pollution increases as the economy ramps up and is working overtime.
How will the president's directive impact us here in Vermont?
Well, in Vermont, we have our own Global Warming Solutions Act that was passed in 2020. And so we already have a commitment in place that by 2030, we'll reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 40% below 1990 levels. So compare that to the new federal commitment, which is not in law as the Vermont one is, which is 50% below 2005 levels. We've made a substantial commitment that is going to get us well on our way there in Vermont. And it was such an achievement to see the legislature pass a law like that, even over the governor's objections in Vermont. So we're doing a good amount here. We have a comprehensive energy plan from 2016 that lays out a lot of strategies for how exactly we're going to improve our energy system and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But, you know, when you look at a federal commitment like this, where all states are kind of being lumped together, at least at this stage, you know, as I said, we don't really know how this is going to break down. Vermont is very unique compared to a lot of other states when it comes to our greenhouse gas impacts. We have the lowest carbon dioxide emissions of any state, and our total energy consumption is the smallest of all states. Most of our energy that we use, or a good deal of the energy that we use in Vermont, comes from out of state. The energy that we're, our electric energy that we're producing, using in Vermont is much more on the renewable side than most any other place. So that's something that's really significant in that, you know, we're trying to move the U.S. toward greater renewable consumption. You know, the coal plants and the massive natural gas consumption that's happening in some other states is not happening here. Mm-hmm. So Vermont is probably not where most of that 50% below 2005 levels by 2030. Vermont is really not where that's likely to be coming from. But that being said, you know, even though Vermont says that we are almost 100% renewable here in terms of our electricity use, that renewable energy is coming from sources like biomass and hydro, hydroelectric energy, which are two pretty controversial sources of renewable energy. And so, you know, if you look below the hood there a little bit, it's not exactly what it appears on the surface.
And I think we're still getting some nuclear right from New Hampshire, from Seabrook, is it?
That may be right.
Yeah, that's part of the mix. People might shake their heads and say, you know, what Vermont does has virtually no impact on the overall picture. Why make big efforts in Vermont when you weigh it against what's happening in China or India? So how do you respond to that?
You know, I think that that kind of thinking is exactly why we have not been able to make significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions anywhere in the world, is that it's always somebody else's problem, right? It's always somebody else's fault. And that has resulted in us not having laws and requirements to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And it's just not going to get better if we all continue to think that way.
All right, let's take a call. Peter is joining us. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Hi. Well, good morning here. It's a pretty good morning for May, I guess. I guess I have a question. Why would I even think about even limiting things of our existence when the Paris Peace Accord, which everybody seemingly loves or whatever, totally allows China to do whatever they want? They're adding coal factories faster than we could possibly make them in America, and doing in India the same way. They're allowed, they're given contracts. Why in the world would you sit and let yourself be subject to that nonsense?
All right, Peter. Peter was probably calling in and Danny was taking his call just as I asked my previous question, which is pretty much what I had asked Jennifer. You know, why worry about what's going on here in Vermont when China and India are polluting? But Jennifer, go ahead and address Peter again on what you answered with me.
Yeah, so in terms of the Paris Agreement, it's true. China does have more greenhouse gas emissions globally than the United States does. India has quite a bit less than the U.S., and so I think that's really in a different category. I mean, when President Biden made this commitment, this greenhouse gas emissions commitment recently, he also sat down with China to show a mutual commitment to doing better on greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, China has committed, I think, to peak their greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. And so they are going to be headed in the right direction. They are going to have to make significant changes to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. You know, they do have many coal-fired power plants. And so we need them on board, and they need to take committed actions as well. But as I was just saying, you know, I think the my opinion is that the framework of they're polluting also, or they're polluting more, and therefore we shouldn't do anything, is exactly what got us into this mess with climate change. And so I would urge that we shouldn't wait for everybody else to do the right thing for us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the best that we can.
Jennifer, another area that we're seeing a lot of concentration is, and you've mentioned it some, is energy efficiency. Are we making strides in this area?
Yeah, certainly. Energy efficiency in buildings in particular, I think, is an area that we've made more progress in the United States. It's a little more manageable, right, than mm-hmm. completely transitioning to a new global energy system, you know, adding insulation to your walls or you know, making changes like that is a little more manageable. So we do see a lot of improvement there. And buildings are not the greatest source of greenhouse gas emissions in general when we talk about sectors. In Vermont, for instance, 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from transportation. Mm. And so that's the sector that I really worry about nationally, but also particularly for a place like Vermont.
So there's been a push, and we only have about a minute left, but this push to electric vehicles. You know, what level of conversion from gas-powered to electric do we need to make to really have an impact on the environment?
Substantial. I mean, the good news is we've done very little on this front, and so any change is going to be a good one and move us in the right direction. The tough thing with electrifying the transportation sector is it takes time, right? Because we're not necessarily expecting people to, you know, get rid of a car that they have. You know, that's I don't think anybody's talking about that kind of mandate. But as people right. purchase new cars and as the technology improves so that they're affordable and efficient and, you know, have really reliable vehicles, people will be purchasing those vehicles more and replacing when they replace the ones that they have. And it seems like manufacturers are really teed up to be able to make a very comprehensive transition to those vehicles. But it's going to need to be pretty comprehensive.
Yeah. Jennifer Rushlow is the director of the Environmental Law Center at Vermont Law School. Jennifer, thanks for being on the program this morning.
This was great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEV Radio. Here's what we got coming up on WDEV. The Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference will come up following CBS News. And don't forget that we've got Greg Hooker today with the getaway from 2 to 4, and it's a special Mother's Day getaway with Greg. That's 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock today on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.